So if I can organize these many commands for you to put a little structure on them, it would be first we have in verses 9 and 12, 9 and 10 the marks of love, and then for a couple of verses the perseverance of love, and then third in verses 13 to 16 at the end, the realism of love and how does love really show itself. But really there is nothing quite like Romans 12, 9 to 16. 20, 21 commands in a row, and you notice no reason given, no statement as to why and where it's going, just command after command after command. And when I read this candidly, I think to myself, what unifies this list? I mean, I've read this list a lot of times, and I still can't remember all the items because it's sort of one thing after another. Can we organize it? And I know it's maybe sometimes tempting to organize too much, but I do think there is a pattern and a few key ideas that organize and allow us to present and maybe remember what these commands are. The commands are about love. It doesn't show in our English translation, but actually several times at the beginning, one of the different words, several words for love in the New Testament, one of the words for love appears, and it organizes the whole. But it really is a series of commands. And if I can just say a word about how the Bible comes to us, most of the time the Bible comes to us in stories, in history. And it says, this is what God has done, and this is how we should respond. Or, this is what God will do, and this is how we should live in light of it. But the Bible comes in many forms, not just stories, sometimes cryptic sayings, sometimes poems, fierce denunciations of sin go on for 10 and 20 chapters. In the prophets of the Old Testament, there are songs of mourning and lamentation and rejoicing. The Bible comes to us in many forms, and they come in forms that we may like. We may like stories more, we may like poetry more, we may like laws more, but God sends his word in every form because we need every form of his word. Not maybe not every one of us, but collectively, since we're different, we resonate to different ways in which God presents himself. So some people love laws and other people cringe at laws. Some people love the laws of God because they say, good, now I know what to do. And others cringe because they say, I'm not doing these things and I feel so guilty. Well, whichever one you are, whatever your taste may be, we do have here, late in the book of Romans, a burst of laws. And love is the theme, love of strangers, love of friends, love of the body of Christ. And although there isn't any context here in this passage, it just starts off by telling us to love, the book of Romans as a whole does provide context. In fact, in chapter 5, we read that God has poured out his love into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, whom he has given us. So God poured love into our hearts. And still in Romans 5, God demonstrates his own love. He proves his love to us in this, that he sent his only son while we were still sinners. And third, nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. That's in Romans chapter 8. So there is love in the overall structure of the book of Romans, and so we can receive what he has to say to us about love. It basically goes like this. God loved us, and we received his love. Therefore, we should love others. In a sense, it's almost that simple. Receive love, therefore show love. And to whom do you show love? Well, you show love, first of all, those who are closest to you, your family, your friends. And then he keeps on moving and saying, those who are unlovely, those who are in distress, even those who are strangers, even those who persecute us. Well, what are the marks of real love? The first mark of real love is found in verse 9. It says, love must be sincere. Literally, the word is, love must be without hypocrisy. That is to say, love is not a show. It's not theater. And the sad truth of the matter is that sometimes our deeds of love are a bit of theater, aren't they? Have you ever had, let me say it this way. Sometimes it's full-blown theater, like when Judas betrayed Jesus with a kiss, pretending he was affectionate. But much, much more often, when we look to show love, it's just a little bit of shallowness in it. For example, you meet a friend, and you say to your friend, how are you doing? And you do it in the way that says, you know, I'm not just looking for a fine thank you. I'm, you know, how are you today? And then your friend starts to answer in a little too much detail. And your friend is going on and on and on, and you're thinking to yourself, I've got a plane to catch. I've got a TV show I need to watch. I'm getting hungry. And you think to yourself, this my friend, this woman, this man is just going on and on, and I'm trying to listen to them, but my mind is elsewhere. And then you halfway through, you realize, oh, I poured on the genuineness at the beginning. I really invited them to tell me. And I have just played a bit of a hypocrite. I pretended I was totally sincere. I put it on, and I didn't mean it as much as I thought. Or much more simply, sometimes we do something very kind and loving for somebody, and we do it partly out of kindness and partly because we might want to ask a favor of them sometime. We want to put them in our debt. In marriage, you know, I think we love each other when we're married. We love our husband. We love our wife. But it's very, very tempting in marriage, isn't it? Not just to love your spouse, but to manage your spouse. And not just to love your spouse, but to fix your spouse, to get your spouse to do the things you want them to do when you want them to do it. I just came up with this crazy illustration. I'm sure it never happened to any of you. But it goes like this. There's a husband and a wife, and they're... you know, they're in the house, and the husband got home a little bit. He has a flexible schedule, and so he got home at 4:30, but then he worked until about 6, and supper's ready, and he's working away, and you know, there's a lot of noise in the kitchen, so he puts some earphones on to block out the noise, and so his beloved wife calls up to him and says, "Supper's ready, dear," and he can't hear because he cranked up the earphones. And she calls again, "Supper's ready, dear," and, "Supper's ready, you. Why don't you take those stupid earphones off your ears? And if you want me to come for supper, why don't you just walk up here instead of screaming from the kitchen?" Now, what's going on there when that happens? What's going on is each one wants the other to do what they want them to do. I want to listen to my music and quiet and have quiet so I can work for a few minutes. And I want you to come up and tap me on the shoulder. And I want you to be ready, this wife says, to come down when it's time to come down. You know what time it is. I told you we'd be eating soon. Now, the husband and wife don't have to be unkind to each other. There doesn't have to be any shouting or anything like that. But each one just wants what they want from the other person instead of truly loving and truly giving to the other. So love is sincere when we're doing more than managing each other's behavior, when we, as Paul says in another place, live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself for us, giving for the other. And again, the apostle says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." Love gives to the other person. It's not, of course, just in homes, right? Not just in a marriage or a family, but at work. We can... there can be a blurring of the distinction between loving and caring for people and simply managing them. If you're perhaps an overseer of some kind at work, you can want your people to do what you want them to do. I would like you to speed up a little. I would like you to slow down a little and make fewer mistakes. And if you do it this way, then all will be well. And you can give a positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, but all you're really trying to do is to get them to do what you want them to do. And if you look at yourself long and hard, you may realize that there's a veneer of caring for the person you're supervising, but really you just want them to do what you want them to do. And that's not necessarily loving. People sometimes do it this way with management techniques. You know, compliment people freely. They'll be happy when they see you coming. Smile and the whole world smiles with you. Tell the truth. It's a lot easier than trying to remember whatever lie you told, and find a service project. You'll make some friends. It's all good advice, but it's all a bit manipulative and not truly oriented to the other person. So love is sincere. The second thing that this passage teaches us is that love is informed. Now it says, the first commands are, love sincerely, hate what is evil. And you may think to yourself, excuse me, but isn't that a non sequitur? What's the connection between loving sincerely and hating what is evil? And I want to propose to you that there is a connection. It's this. Hatred of evil, the proper hatred of evil, actually helps us love. It reminds us that love is not blind sentimentality. That to truly love, you have to be discerning. One place the Bible says, "Test all things, hold fast to what is good." You have to test everything. There's a place in Proverbs where it says this, "There are 6 things the Lord hates, 7 that are detestable to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked schemes, feet that run into evil, a false witness, a man who stirs up dissension among his brothers. Now, those are all things that God hates, and aren't they all things that destroy love? Dissension, lying, pride. See, if you really want to love somebody, you have to hate the evils that could hurt them. You love your kids? I'm going to overstate it a little bit. If you really love your kids, you hate their bad classmates. You hate their evil playmates. If you really love your kids, you hate that coach that doesn't treat them right. Now, when I say hate, you don't really hate them. Not like you want to destroy them or something like that. But there's a sense in which if you really love your kids, you're going to get angry about those people that harm your kids. If you really love your husband or your wife, there's a sense in which you hate their cruel boss. Now, if you meet them, you're not going to be cruel to them, but you hate what that boss does. You hold on to what's good. You're not blind. To truly love somebody, you have to hate what harms or destroys them. That's what Paul's saying. We're also supposed to be devoted to one another in brotherly love, the next verse says. Now, what does that mean? For those of you who like to take notes and jot things down, I've got a 1, 2, 3, 4 for you. There are actually four different words in the New Testament for love, or in Greek literature, and one of them never appears in the New Testament. There are three that appear in the New Testament. The one that is in Greek that doesn't appear in the Bible is the word eros for romantic love, but the other three are, number one, agape. You've probably all heard of agape, and that's godlike, sacrificial, loving of enemies, loving of the needy, of the poor, loving people that can't do anything for you. We love because God first loved us. That's agape love. The second kind of love is philia, or the love of friendship, as in our name of our city, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. And that's the word that's used here in this verse when it says love is devoted. There it is. You see, be devoted to one another. What's actually in that little phrase in verse 10, be devoted, is have philia to each other. And that word means have affection, be brotherly. Philia is the love we have for people we like, people who, I don't know, have you swapped music playlists with somebody and found out they like the same music you like to a ridiculous degree? And what happens when you find out they like the same music you do? You like them a little more than you did an hour ago. You say, your taste is the same as my taste, and my tastes are fabulous. Therefore, you have fabulous taste. Therefore, I like you more than ever. There is nothing wrong with affection. He's saying, be devoted. Have affection toward each other. The human attraction to someone who has skill or virtue or excellence is not only permitted, it's commanded here. The next word for love in the New Testament is storge. And that word means love of affection between family members. This kind of love you feel for maybe a cousin or an aunt or an uncle or your children or your spouse, but sort of not the romantic side of it, but the kindly affection side. And that's the next word that's used here. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. That's that word storge appears there. And that's saying that love is familial affection. Let me tell you a misconception I picked up a long time ago. When I was a new Christian, I heard for the first time about agape and about God's selfless sacrificial love for us. And people said, that's the best kind of love. And the more I study the New Testament, the more I find that's not quite true. Oh, of course, it's the highest and noblest and most difficult love to love those who hate you and despise you and offer nothing to you. But the Bible blesses and commends warm and affectionate love for each other, too. A long, warm hug, a sense of, I'm glad to see you, throwing your arm around somebody. God is very pleased when that happens. If you heard that true love, true godly love, Christian love, is dispassionate and goes out exactly the same to enemies and friends, you heard something that's sort of 60% true. It is good and noble to love people that don't love you back, and that's how God loved us first. It is good. But God is pleased when we're affectionate to each other and when we feel warm. Let me say it a totally different way. How many of you here have a pet iguana? How many of you here have a pet dog? Look around. Why do we have more pet dogs than pet iguanas? Because affection is good. That's why. And God made us to enjoy affection. All right, the next thing is that love shows honor to each other. That means we should be quick to recognize, to give credit, to give thanks. Literally what it says here is we should go before one another in showing honor. We should outdo or surpass each other in showing honor. It's how we love each other. Have you ever done something really good and nobody noticed? Anybody raise your hand if that's happened to you? And then you did it again and still nobody noticed? And then you began to feel sorry for yourself. Nobody noticed the good thing that I did. Can I tell you the cure for the heartache when you do something good that nobody noticed? The cure is to look around and ask the question, have I seen anybody do anything good that wasn't noticed? Or I'm not sure it was noticed. And you run to that person, you say, thank you. Thank you for what you did. Outdo one another. Surpass one another, Paul says, in showing each other honor. Stop asking the question, why doesn't anybody appreciate me? And instead ask the question, who can I go and appreciate? Who can I go and thank? To whom should I be alert and say a good word? I know that some of you in this room excel at this. One of them is my dear friend Lance, who's sitting over there. He is so good at finding things that people do well. There's Bruce in the back. He's really good at it too. And Jeff is good at it. And others here are good at it. And so pass it around. Show that you want to honor others by seeing what they do. What a blessing that'll be if you find people. Give up ambition and conceit and pride and show kindness to others. There are other ways to honor others above yourselves. And I want to tell you a story that just gripped me that I read a number of months ago. I was reading a little bit of scientific history. And the story goes like this. In the 1990s, late 1990s, as we know, the cell phone industry was taking off. And cell phones, like all new technologies, have a lot of parts. And you need a lot of minerals and compounds to make it work. And cell phones, I'm not sure if it's still that way today. I think it is. At least a year ago or 2 years ago it was true. Cell phones need either tantalum or niobium. And I know those are both household words that you've probably used several times today. They're both elements. They're both rare earth elements. And one is number 73, one is number 41 in the periodic table, and they're not common. And they are found generally in two places, in East Africa and in Australia. And it's most easily available in East Africa, in the Congo, on the border with Rwanda. That's where the number one supply is, and it just kind of lies there. Tantalum and niobium lie there in sort of muddy deposits. Looks like mud at first, but it's actually very valuable. And when the industry took off, then the farmers realized that they could make as much in 1 or 2 days just shoveling this niobium, tantalum-rich mud. They could make as much in 2 days as they could in a whole year farming. And so naturally they were doing that. The problem is this. 1998 at the border of Rwanda and the Congo is when we were at the height of the Hutu-Tutsi conflict where so many people were being killed. And that money that was going into that area was finding its way into armaments. And that money was enabling the conflict to escalate, and people were killing each other with the weapons they bought from the proceeds of the niobium and the tantalite. And the world's producers of cell phones figured that out after a while. And they all agreed that although it would cut their profits, they all agreed that they would stop buying those elements from the Congo. And they went to get them in Australia, where they're harder to find, more expensive, harder to process, out of honor for the people of that land, out of love for those people, people they didn't even know. So love has these marks, and it includes this last mark of honoring one another. Now, the second thing, much more briefly, is that real love perseveres. It says in our verse that's up there, verse 11, love is fervent. Now, here's the issue. Here we are. We're Presbyterians, and we aren't usually all that fervent. Sometimes we sing a song fervently, and maybe, you know, if we're really hyped up, we take notes fervently. Or we might write down prayer requests fervently. We're fervent about some things, but we're not, you know, real enthusiastic types. And you know, some people think that other people push around their spiritual enthusiasm to make, you know, feels like they're making themselves look good. And they're super spiritual, and I'm a spiritual mud puppy. And that's really not the way we should think about this at all. What Paul is saying is this. Love is fervent means love keeps going. Love is not slothful. Love is not lazy. Love continues whether it's easier or whether it's hard. Love is willing to get up early for a cause even if we're a little bit tired. Love is excited about working for God or working for our neighbor. Love shows itself when we keep on going. You know the way it is. Sometimes you don't want to get started, but you have to tell yourself, I need to get going. And that's an act that can be very much an act of love, to keep going when you don't want to. Or when you do get excited about serving God or serving your neighbor, to keep at it, to say, this is good, Lord, I love what I'm doing, and keep pushing and serving and being joyful in hope, verse 12, and patient in affliction and faithful in prayer. All that means is that when hope starts to run out, we don't give up hope. When there's affliction, we continue. When we need to pray and we don't have an answer, we keep praying. Love perseveres. Love perseveres when we want to quit. When was the last time you wanted to quit? Maybe it was an hour and a half ago. Maybe it was this morning. Maybe it was Wednesday. Maybe it was 2 months ago. When was the last time you said something like, I just can't help myself. I can't stop. I can't start. Love perseveres. It keeps on praying. It doesn't give up. And love is realistic, verses 13 to 16 tell us. It gives us some very particular statements. In verse 13 it says, You know how love is real? When it shares with those who are needy. Share with those who are needy. Practice hospitality. The word hospitality literally means love of stranger. And to share with the needy means to share your life with the needy person. Now, when we say hospitality in our culture, we often don't distinguish between hospitality and entertainment, right? We say, what a hospitable person. They had 14 people over to their house the other day. Well, that's not exactly the same thing. Hospitality in the Bible is when you bring somebody over that's never invited and probably never will invite you to their house. It's having your eye open for the needy. Can I just brag about my wife for a minute? My wife used to be an entertainer. And everything had to be just so when we first got married. And now I tell you, it is a way of life. That if there's someone who doesn't have a meal, doesn't have a place to go at Christmas or Thanksgiving or Easter, you know, she finds out you will be invited over to her house. It may not have happened to you because you don't talk to her enough, but that's the way she is. I knew how she had progressed. It was been probably a year ago by now when there was a young man who had many hardships in his life. He wasn't even a friend of ours. He was a friend of our kids, our children's friend, and a young but grown man. And he was at our house one day, and my wife said to him, he was staying, he had a meal and he was staying overnight, and she said, hey, you know, I know you've been here before, but you know, the towels are in the closet in, you know, opposite the bathroom upstairs at the top of the steps. And he looked at my wife and he said, do you not know how many times I've slept at your house? He said, I know where the towels are. I know where the sheets are. I know where the soap is. I know where the shampoo is. I know where it all is. And she said, I don't know how many times you've been at my house. It was probably 20 times that he'd slept at our house. And that's hospitality. We grew to like him a lot. But we first met him because he didn't have anywhere to go. And that's my wife. And I hope that you have hospitality. I hope that you bring people into your life, into your home. That's a practical way to show love. And verse 14 says that love blesses even our enemies and those who persecute us. It says we don't repay evil for evil. When anger rises against someone, when someone is mean-spirited or unjust, it's so easy to return insult for insult and anger for anger. That's what starts wars, you know? What's going on between the Israelis and the Palestinians? Between the Pakistanis and the Indians? A few years ago, between the Bosnians and the Serbs, and on and on. It's because somebody says, I'll pay you back, I'll pay you back, I'll pay you back, I'll pay you back. It's evil for evil and evil for evil. And Paul says, fight the instinct for self-defense. Bless your enemies. Love those who persecute you. Verse 15 maybe even gives us a hint as to how. Verse 15 says, love is sympathetic. That means we have the ability to feel what other people feel. We rejoice with those who rejoice. We weep with those who weep. You know, it's not always easy when you're with somebody who's weeping. When you're happy and they're weeping, it takes an act of love, of selflessness, to stop being happy about what you're happy about and to feel what they feel so you can weep with them. Or when you're miserable and someone has something marvelous happen, it is an act of love to lay aside your misery and to say, I will rejoice with you, my friend, and maybe even keep your sorrow to yourself. Love is also harmonious and humble. Verse 16. I'm going to paraphrase it this way. You know, it says we should associate with everybody. I'm going to paraphrase it this way. Don't be a snob. You know, there's a phrase. I'm going to sound judgmental for a second, okay? There's a phrase that really bothers me, and the phrase is, it's a small world. It bothers me when people say, it's a small world. I keep running into my friends. You know what? You know why that bothers me? Because it isn't a small world. It's a really big world. There's actually more than 6 billion people, and the globe is quite large. And in fact, when people say, you know, St. Louis is such a small city, I keep running into my friends. What you're really saying is, I just go to places where people like me hang out. What you're saying is, I'm kind of a snob. And I don't mingle with other people. I just go to the places where my people are. Well, maybe I just stepped on some toes. And if I did, and you need to have your toes stepped on, then so be it. Because we should spend time with people who aren't like us. And when I see people who aren't like us, I mean people who are older and younger, and people who are taller and shorter, and people who are more and less educated and have more and less money, and people who live in other neighborhoods, and who have tastes that we don't necessarily have. And not shun them and avoid them. But what do we have here in this passage? We actually have some progress. It goes like this. First, in the beginning, it says we should love our brothers and feel affection and honor people who are honorable. And the second thing it says is we should keep it up, even when we're flagging a bit. We should be fervent. And the third thing it says is we should love the needy and strangers. We should love people we don't even know. And then finally, it says we should love people who are really different from us, people who aren't our kind, people who don't have our mood, people, it mentions, even who persecute us. And we have to ask the question again, what's the motive for that? And the motive for that is this: the person and work of Jesus Christ. See, everything I just told you is something that Jesus did. His daily life was him coming and befriending us, him feeling affection for us. When we were far away from us, he befriended us. When we were strangers to him, he loved us and welcomed us to himself. When we were completely disinterested, he came and became our friend and loved sacrificially, but also loved affectionately. So live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself for us. If I may, I'm going to go straight to the Lord's Supper now, because you see, really, what better picture is there of the love that Jesus has for us than this, that he gave his life for his friends? On The night when he was betrayed, he was with his disciples, and he was sharing a meal with them. And, you know, there were 12 of them in this space. And of the 12, one stayed with him all the way to the end through his crucifixion. And one, Judas, betrayed him, and 10 fled to save their skins. And yet Jesus loved them all. And he shared a meal with them, and at that meal he took bread that was part of the bread of that meal, and he broke it, and he said, "This bread is my body, which is broken for you. Take and eat." And he also took a cup that they passed around in those days. Everybody drank from a common cup. And he said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood shed for many, shed for the remission of your sins. Drink ye all of it." That was his love. Affectionate love, tender love, patient love, love for strangers when we didn't yet know him. And so he invites us to share in that love.